Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to another newly recorded episode of Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. And I'm going to be speaking today with Leslie Crutchfield. She's Executive Director of the Global Social Enterprise Initiative at Georgetown University's McDonough School of Business. And we're going to talk about her new book, How Change Happens, Why Some Social Movements Succeed While Others Don't. And you can learn more at howchangehappens.com. That's howchangehappens.com. After a three-year hiatus, I've been doing a new interview every other week or so since Trump's Electoral College victory, and this is the 40th such interview. Paul Hawken on climate change, Naomi Klein on her book No Is Not Enough, Arlie Hochschild on her book Strangers in Their Own Land and the Stories That Divide Us, and Robert Wright on why he's a Buddhist, things like that. The show airs as specials on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA, streams weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on tunein.com, and podcasts are available anytime, anywhere on iTunes, Podomatic.com, and at my site, TerrenceMcNally.net, TerrenceMcNally.net. This is the first new interview for me since the midterm elections. I was out of town for a couple of weeks, and while not the wholesale repudiation Trump and his enablers deserved, results were heartening. Just, you've probably heard a lot of this, but I'm going to run through the things I found most heartening, especially California, where every congressional seat in Orange County went blue, and the last undecided race in the country in California's 21st up in the San Joaquin Valley has a Democrat now in the lead. Both the turnout and the turnabout were big. Dems gained more House seats than in any election since the Watergate era of 1974. 8.6 million more Americans voted for Democrats in House races, and the margin of voters was even greater in Senate races, even though Republicans added seats. That's sort of a quirk of who was running and who was defending in which states. At least 80 women were elected to the House, 69 Democrats, including 27 newcomers. Jared Polis, the first openly gay man to win a governor's race. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the youngest woman ever elected to Congress. Ayanna Pressley, Massachusetts' first black congresswoman. Minnesota's Ilhan Omar, Michigan's Rashida Tlaib, became the first Muslim woman elected to Congress. When Trump was elected, I hoped that the response would ultimately outweigh the damage he might do. By that, I mean that the wake-up call would reach people who'd fallen asleep as citizens, that they would realize the emergency, and not just that they would get involved, but that they would demand and embody change, ask more of their leaders when it comes to health care, college, inequality, climate, challenge dead ideas. And the action in the midterms, the results of the midterms tell me that that is happening. And my hope now is that we can sustain that, having been given that wake-up call, that the ultimate result when we look back in a few years is that things have gone further in the right direction than they were taken in the wrong direction by this administration. Now, while elections and politics matter a great deal, a vital society demands so much more. And in this hour, we're going to explore why some changes in society take hold and others don't. In How Change Happens, Leslie Crutchfield examines movements that have succeeded in spectacular fashion, from tobacco control, and on the other side, gun rights expansion, to marriage equality and acid rain reduction, as well as other recent campaigns that haven't, like Occupy Wall Street, carbon emissions control, gun violence prevention. If you're involved in working for social progress, economic justice, or environmental stewardship, listen up for the lessons you and your organizations and movements can deploy if you're committed to successfully impacting society and the planet moving forward. Leslie Crutchfield, Executive Director of the Global Social Enterprise Initiative at Georgetown University's McDonough School of Business, co-founded a nonprofit social enterprise in her 20s. She was a managing director at Ashoka, the global venture fund for social entrepreneurs founded by Bill Drayton, who's been a guest on this show a couple of times over the years. She served on nonprofit boards, including Seed Foundation and Kiva. And her books include Forces for Good, The Six Practices of High-Impact Nonprofits, co-authored with Heather McLeod Grant, Do More Than Give, The Six Practices of Donors Who Change the World, co-authored with John Kania and Mark Kramer, and her latest, How Change Happens, Why Some Social Movements Succeed While Others Don't. And it turns out that one also has six principles, so I think she's found that six Six is the group that she finds things happen in. Welcome, Leslie Crutchfield, to Freeform, a World That Just Might Work. And let me just tell listeners, we're recording this interview on Wednesday, November 28th, 2018. Welcome, Leslie.
Thanks for having me, Terrence.
I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the ideas and the work that we talk about. I often say to guests, I'm having a conversation with you, not with your book or your organization. So can you share a bit about your path to the work you do today? And not just the last couple of years, but feel free to mention mentors or turning points or moments of decision along the way.
When I look at my more than 25 years of my career that's been in the social sector here in the United States primarily, there's always been this common thread between kind of fascination with what drives social change, how do you drive impact, and writing, publishing, developing new knowledge, and sharing ideas. And that's kind of come to fruition in three different buckets, you know, over the course of my career. You know, as you mentioned, for the first decade or so, when I was in my 20s, my co-founders and I launched a social enterprise. We published a national magazine about social entrepreneurship and how change happens in the nonprofit world. Then I went back and got my MBA, and then for the second kind of decade was on the impact investing side, working with Ashoka to invest in startup organizations, trying to scale out impact in the United States and Canada. And then for the last decade or so, I've been researching, writing, trying to understand what are some of the systemic factors that can enable change makers to see the impact that they want to create in the world, and also what holds them back. And I'm really curious about patterns and believe really strongly that you got to study all sides of issues. You know, success can come on both the left and the right side of the political aisle and everywhere in between. So really keeping an open mind so that you can understand what really drives impact and leave some of the politics and personal stuff out.
Okay, and one of the things that you talk about I want to talk first a little bit about this project that results in this book, the research and so on, but first question about that is, you mentioned that a key perspective that you take in this is systems thinking and networks, and can you talk about why you took that approach and what that means?
Well, and how change happens. My colleagues here at Georgetown University and I were really trying to understand why some movements succeed and others don't. So it was a comparative look, as you mentioned, you know, why has gun rights expansion, for instance, been so successful since the 1990s and until very recently gun violence prevention been relatively weak? How is it in the world of the environment were we able to virtually eliminate acid rain in North America, but now we're stuck on carbon cuts? And so forth. And, you know, when we look at some of the studies that have been made of movements from the past, you know, there's been probably hundreds of millions of pages written about civil rights movement, suffrage, even prohibition, the first wave of the environmental movement. And we really wanted to look at changes that have happened in our lifetimes, you know, since the turn of the 21st century, because the socioeconomic, political climate is different, right? We looked at changes that have happened in the post-Tea Party era, and that has had a significant impact on how social and environmental progress happens or does not happen. So we wanted to get out of some of the kind of more traditional mental models of progressive, you know, groups fighting up, rising up in protest of, you know, maybe corporate wrongdoing. Certainly there's some of that in our book, and we wanted to kind of get beyond that to see how larger systems changes happen. And as a result, one of the things we looked at in our study was what has been the role of corporations in many of these big changes, whether tobacco control or LGBT marriage equality, drunk driving reduction, or, you know, gun rights expansion. Because it's not always the case where you have, you know, the evil empire, a corporation doing all the wrong, and it's about fighting against them. In many ways, companies have played a very invisible or nuanced role that's helped either advance or hold back these causes. So we look at all of the factors, the NGOs, the individual citizens, the roles of companies, and, of course, the role of politicians and government.
Yeah, no, that makes very good sense to me that when you start looking at really how change happens, I have a feeling we're going to be saying that title a lot because it's what we're talking about. It's that good versus evil, black versus white, past versus present, those things, they're dramatic. They're what you may see at one moment or from one perspective. But this larger thing that when you really had to look at what made movements succeed or fail, that's where this whole systems thing of interdependent relationships and dynamics and things really comes into play. First of all, what led you to set this goal for this project, which was to examine how change happens and to look at both organizations and then movements? And how did you do the research? And I know you credit, you were co-authored on both of your other books. This one, you're the sole author, but you do credit your research team as being sort of your co-author.
We conducted the research here for several years at Georgetown in the business school with support from the Global Social Enterprise Initiative, which was founded by Bill Novelli, a professor here at Georgetown. He is co-founder of Porter Novelli, the global communications firm. He went on to run CARE USA, helped found the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids, which ended up being one of the real protagonists in the book as we write about the tobacco control movement, and then went on to lead the AARP for about a decade before joining the faculty here at Georgetown. So Bill and the team here created a fellowship so that I could take a sabbatical from FSG and really spend 3 years mucking around in movements and trying to understand with a group of graduate students why some succeed and some fail. The idea for writing the book, How Change Happened, really has its seeds in my first book, Forces for Good, which was all about the best practices of high-impact nonprofits. And we had studied a range of new nonprofits that had come on the scene in the last few decades. So everything from Teach for America to Habitat for Humanity to Environmental Defense Fund to National Council of La Raza, all these post-civil rights era organizations that had gone from zero to great, if you will, in a matter of decades. And in that first book, Forces for Good, we were trying to understand why did some nonprofits really take off and have big impact versus others that were more average performers. And the big aha that came out of Forces for Good was that great nonprofits build movements, not just their organizations, right? So while you're trying to scale out and replicate to new sites and add new programs and services, the best nonprofits were also trying to move the needle on larger causes, right? Teach for America was putting teachers and continues to put teachers in under-resourced schools today, but they also were building the vanguard of the education reform movement of the 21st century, starting charter schools, going on to take positions in leadership, whether governorships, you know, their vision is one day a president of the United States will be a Teach for America alum, and then what kind of system national changes can you make? So I always had in the back of my mind this idea around movements, and I was percolating, okay, well, what does it take to build a successful movement? And that led to this book, How Change Happens, where we didn't study one organization or one donor, but the field of actors from nonprofit, corporate, government, individual citizens that come together to rise up to drive these big changes. And that's what led to How Change Happens. Now, sometimes there's a full-fledged movement, right? You would call the tobacco control movement certainly such. Sometimes it's campaigns. You know, in the campaign for LGBT marriage equality, that was set in a much longer, larger movement for equality and tolerance for LGBT community members, right? So whether you call it a campaign or mm-hmm. a movement, we were trying to look at the confluence of actors and strategies and approaches that coalesced to create these changes. And then we were comparing them to other issues that have seemed stuck or might be emerging and trying to figure out what the winners do that others are not doing, or maybe not doing quite as well. And that led to the insights in How Change Happens.
Mm-hmm. And so your team digs deep into different movements, and then you notice patterns, you notice trends, you begin to see what coalesces, and that's what ends up in this. Let me say, by the way, this book is what, before the notes, 220 pages, something like that?
Yeah, so what we did was, you know, we took a handful of the biggest changes, whether social or environmental changes in the 21st century, that have happened, and then another handful that are just emerging or seem stuck,
mm-hmm.
and we studied them. We didn't study all of the big shifts in the 21st century. You know, some of the big ones that we did look at, obviously gun rights expansion, LGBT marriage equality, the abandonment of smoking driven by the tobacco control movement, drunk driving reduction, acid rain elimination. We looked at one global issue, the near eradication of polio worldwide. And then we looked at other issues to compare them to. And it took about 3 years, and we interviewed leaders from all of the different organizations and advocacy groups and campaigns. We interviewed funders. We interviewed some of the icons, the individual leaders, and took copious notes. And as we looked through each movement, patterns began to emerge where we saw, hey, these guys are all doing a lot, for instance, around grassroots. And we looked at some of the movements where they were faltering or maybe not getting as much traction. There wasn't a lot of investment or a really strong approach around grassroots. So that became the first chapter in the book. So
mm-hmm.
each chapter in How Change Happens is a strategy or an approach that was common across all of these successful movements that some of the less successful movements or emerging movements might have lacked or not have done as well.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing I'll say is, you know, we didn't capture everything that every movement does to drive success. For instance, there's not an entire chapter on litigation strategies.
Mm-hmm.
And the book isn't really organized the way a traditional organizing or movement-leading manual might be constructed,
mm-hmm.
Because it was case-based, bottom-up, looking at these changes and seeing what emerged as the patterns.
Yeah, and I notice there's, while if I could get that manual, it would include something about fundraising and would include things about governance. That's not in this either, really, in depth, but it's these principles that bubbled up. And you've been in this field, as we described, in your, you know, in your career path for years, decades. What most surprised you?
Well, I'll tell you what's most surprised me since the book has come out and
mm-hmm.
changemakers are reading it and trying to apply these lessons to the causes that they're driving forward. This was the big surprise. Out of the six factors that we talk about, the one that everybody, it just resonates with everybody and everybody gloms onto is this idea of sharpening your 10-10-10-20=50 vision. And that was kind of a sleeper. That rubric comes straight out of the playbook of the gay marriage equality movement. And the idea is that, you know, we're not one monolithic country of 50 states. It's each state and region in the U.S. is unique. And if you're going to drive change, you know, number one lesson is you've got to look state by state and push for state and local reform, policy, laws, regulations, as well as norm change, starting where each of the regions at the local level are at in this country. And, you know, Texas is in a really different place from New York, which is in a really different place from Minnesota. So you've got to really take a 10-10-10-20 adds up to 50 view. And the winning movements that we studied got that, right? You know, I think a lot about in the headlines today as movements are roiling the nation. You know, I think about the populist movement that led to the election of our current president. That's become an anvil against which so many other movements are fomenting, whether it's, you know, Me Too and the fight against sexual abuse or immigration protests about child separation at the border. You know, so many of these issues rising up and around that. The movements that have actually seen concrete changes happen in their direction figured out that they've got to go for incremental change state by state in a long-term play. It can take decades to win that before going for any big national or federal push. And movements that do the opposite, where they try and start with the feds and start nationally and ignore or don't take the time to work incrementally state by state, usually end up losing.
Mm-hmm. I can imagine, for instance, if you look at the civil rights movement and you weren't there and you weren't in it, what you see is voting rights law, March on Washington, right? And you, of course, you heard about Rosa Parks and you heard about the Woolworth sit-ins and so on, but you may forget everything that happened community by community before those national events and national legislation take place.
Exactly.
So I do find that fascinating that when I ask you about the surprise, it's the surprise that comes back to you after you're finished, and that one, the 10, 10, 10 plus 20 equals 50, I can see why that's the one people don't see. Grassroots, leadership, message, hearts and policy. I think people go kind of, they thought they knew that, but that particular one that you have to set, that if you really want to achieve the big thing, set achievable goals. I can remember I was actually at the birth of an education nonprofit, and I remember one of the things we said is, what we want is little victories, that you can build on little victories. Tell the story of where that 10, 10, 10 plus 20 equals 50 came from, because it's actually very specific. It isn't just some professor's theory. It came out of a crisis in a movement.
Absolutely. Well, it came out of the LGBT equality movement, and as leaders in the community were advocating for marriage, they had a state view in mind, but it really came to crystallize at a meeting in Jersey City, New Jersey in the early 2000s. And this was a time when the LGBT marriage equality movement was really on the ropes, right? We had DOMA. President Clinton had signed the Defense of Marriage Act, defining it as only between a man and a woman. You had 13 states with ballot referendums underway to ban gay marriage. The only place in the early 2000s where it was legal to marry was Massachusetts. But there was a vociferous backlash underway led by leaders of the Catholic Church, Mitt Romney, who was there at the time. So it was a really dour moment. And I think about it, today, a lot of people doing 20/20 hindsight, Monday morning quarterbacking will say, well, it was inevitable that we got gay marriage, right? The will and grace effect. Well, that's not how that change happened, right? It at that moment in the early 2000s, LGBT marriage looked impossible, not inevitable. So some leaders got together in this conference room in Jersey City, New Jersey. Tim Gill, one of the main donors in this movement, a mega donor out of Colorado, had convened them. And you had Evan Wolfson, the founder of Freedom to Marry, Mary Bonato, who argued the Supreme Court case, leaders from ACLU, probably GLAD, Lambda, HRC, a number of the organizations. I don't know exactly who was all in the room, but they got together and they said, we're on the ropes, and what are we going to do? We got to defend that marriage bill that just passed in Massachusetts. And they did this thought experiment. They said, well, what if we took the country and we divided it up and we took 10 states and decided to really go for full marriage equality? We won in Massachusetts. Let's defend it in Massachusetts, and then let's go down to New York. There's a lot of progressives in New York. Maybe we can get something done there, right? Then let's take 10 states and we'll just try and go for civil unions. It's separate and unequal, but it's a lot better than what we got right now. And then we'll take 10 states and we will just try and get relationship recognition laws, health benefit packages, that sort of thing. And then we'll take 20 states, half of the U.S. states, and we won't even try to do anything very fancy. We'll just take discriminatory laws off the books that are still there. So let's go to Texas and take the sodomy laws off the books. And that's what they did. So each region of the country, each state and locality, they had a tailored campaign that would move it one incremental step forward towards tolerance, maybe not towards full marriage or even any kind of formal relationship recognition, but away from where things stood. And that ended up being a winning strategy, because by building up a groundswell of support state by state, by the time the Supreme Court was hearing the case in 2015, that landmark case that legalized gay marriage, then you already had this groundswell of support across the states. The other thing that 10, 10, 10, 20 equals 50 exercise helped crystallize was, there was a lot of dissension in the movement. And every movement faces this, whether you've won or whether you're struggling. There's a lot of internecine warfare. We call it reckoning with your adversarial allies.
When I listened to an interview, and someone who was interviewing you said, and reckoning with your adversaries. And there's a subtle distinction. It isn't reckoning with your adversaries. It isn't taking on the gun industry that you're talking about with this principle. It's your adversarial allies. It's the problems you have on your side of the fence.
Yes, this is one of the reasons why so many movements implode. So in LGBT marriage equality, there was a camp that wanted to go for full marriage, maybe a third.
Mm-hmm.
Then there was a third who didn't want anything to do with marriage. We don't want to get married in the traditional way. We don't want to be like straight people.
Right.
We're proud. We're queer, right?
Exactly.
And then there was the rest of the community that said, we don't really care about marriage. That might be a privileged gay person on the coast problem, but here in the heartland, we're getting bashed, we're getting beat up, we can't get jobs, we can't get houses, right? So we have much more fundamental problems than being allowed to get married, right? So there was all this strife and conflict in the movement. And so what that 10-10-10-20=50 state vision enabled them to do was, all right, if you just want to work on anti-discrimination campaigns, go for it. Go to the states where that's what you can get done. If you want to work on full marriage, go to New York. Go back to California, where they had allowed gay marriage. Then you guys in California banned it and then finally reinstated it. And so it allowed different players in the movement to act in unison. You know, and the great leaders that we write about in these movements, they really act more like conductors of an orchestra. So it's about getting all the different players to try and play in harmony, not all singing the same tune, not everybody's doing the exact same melody, but if you can play in harmony and work towards a shared common vision, move in a general direction that's positive, then you can get some real traction.
Yeah, and one thing I love about the conductor image is that the conductor, he very likely does not play violin as well as the violinist, cello as well as the cellist, et cetera, et cetera, that people have their individual skills. What a great leader does is, again, going back to that notion of systems, within that system of that organization or movement, is lets everyone play to their strength.
Exactly.
Let me say a couple of things about the 10-10-10-20-50 that occurred to me as you were speaking. One is, although it emerged as dividing the country, are looking at the country as 50 states with 50 different cultures and 50 different policy prospects and so on. This, if I were just wanting to change something in California or even just wanting to change something in my city, would this same approach of looking around and going, well, that neighborhood or that industry looks ripe for this action, this one looks a little more hesitant, is that same idea of breaking things into manageable chunks where you can win victories at different levels, all of which builds momentum, does it work, you know, in those sorts of constructs as well?
Absolutely. You can telescope it down to a state level or a community level. And you can telescope it up to a global level.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you look at polio eradication movement, you know, we've eliminated polio in 99.9% of the places on Earth. And, you know, if you ask the average person why we've been able to make so much progress against that disease, you know, you might say, well, Bill Gates pouring billions into that issue. But when you talk to people in global health, in these movements, to a one, they'll tell you, it's Rotary International, and it's worldwide network of 33,000 chapters with millions of members in every country on the face of the earth. They, through that grassroots army, built the social and political will to convince countries, health ministers, prime ministers to take on polio as a priority, raised the initial seed money, $250 million, went to Gates, got him involved, got WHO involved, and then built it from there. So you can telescope it up, but you've got to have that same kind of country-by-country strategy. And that principle really ties into another big one that was an aha in the book. You know, the first chapter is called Turn Grassroots Gold, and that while that might sound obvious, right, of course, to have a movement, you've got to have grassroots. So that's why it was so surprising to us that winning movements had big, vociferous, voluminous grassroots efforts, and movements that didn't invest in that and didn't build that up lost. So it's 101, but movements continue to make the mistake to this day, to their peril.
Well, one of the things that I think the points you make is that, well, you make it actually in another one, but I would think it happens here too, is that if you think your resources are limited, and they probably are, time, people, money, and so on, sometimes you say, well, we've got to focus. And so you make the point when you're talking about hearts and policy, and we'll talk about that in a second. But I think the same thing with grassroots and, you know, do I build a grassroots in my town, or do I go straight to Sacramento or straight to Washington? And some people may say, well, we don't have enough, you know, we don't have the resources to do both. You're saying that's a mistake you can't afford to make if you want to succeed.
So let me give you a very current example. This midterm election where we flipped the House, that was in many ways a referendum on health care mm-hmm. for all in this country. There were a lot of other issues at play, too. We know immigration, Trump, racism, all kinds of mm-hmm. all kinds of issues. When you look at how the health care for all movement was built over the last several decades, it's not one we studied in our book because when we were doing our research, it was still very much in play.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But, you know, last summer, and, you know, we had a Republican in the White House, both houses of Congress, Republican-led, could not repeal and replace Obamacare. Why? Because every time a congressional member went back to the home district, thousands of angry voters showed up and spoke up and said, please don't take away my affordable health care. I have pre-existing conditions.
Right.
I like universal health care, right? So they demanded it. But that didn't just come out of thin air. That was two decades of organizing. And more specifically, when you follow the money, you know, one of the biggest donors to the healthcare rights movement was Atlantic Philanthropies. It used to be an anonymous donor, but the founder of Duty Free
right.
Empire. Atlantic Philanthropies put about $250 million. Most of that money went into state and local coalitions where they were advocating for whatever they could get for affordable care at the state level, right? So they had a very strong state and local presence. They had grassroots advocates that were organized and mobilized. And because they had been part of the policymaking process, they were very invested in defending it, right? Now, look at another law that did not pass during that same time frame under the Obama administration, Waxman-Markey. Like, if you care about climate, you know, environmentalists are focused a lot on carbon cuts these days as one of the key areas. Waxman-Markey, the cap and trade proposal
right.
to cut carbon emissions, failed. One of the reasons I think, based on my research, that it can explain that more than anything is that there wasn't as much of a focus on the grassroots. There weren't thousands of angry people at the local congressional district level demanding that their representatives stick and vote for this, right? They didn't have that outside push. They had a lot of money coming into the big green groups in Washington. They had a lot of buy-in from elected officials who paid lip service to the idea. But when it came down to it, they didn't have the grassroots energy to hold the elected officials accountable. So when you look at any of the big progressive causes coming up these days, whether it's climate and carbon or gun violence prevention, Me Too, whatever it is, you've got to be building up that vociferous grassroots bottom-up push to complement whatever conversations you're having in the elite halls on Capitol Hill.
Well, I mean, it reminds me of the famous story that when Franklin Roosevelt was elected during the Depression, he had been in New York fairly much a moderate. Much of what happened in that first 100 days would not have been predicted from the Franklin Roosevelt we knew. After the election, a lot of the farmers and labor and so on came to confront him in the White House, and he said, you have to make me do it. And that,
yes.
If anything is, you know, it's that to me has always been the thing. Let me tell people that you're listening to Free Forum, World That Just Might Work. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Leslie Crutchfield. She's the executive director of the Global Social Enterprise Initiative at Georgetown University's McDonough School of Business. And we're talking about the findings in her research project and book, How Change Happens, Why Some Social Movements Succeed While Others Don't. You can learn more at howchangehappens.com. And you can follow the Global Social Enterprise on Twitter at GSEI_Georgetown, at GSEI_Georgetown. I don't know necessarily at movements, but I was looking at how ideas sort of take hold and what even a single organization might want to do. And I thought, if you can work people through three stages, if you can get their attention, if you can engage them, and then what I called if you can activate them. And what I meant by that is that find them wherever they are and move them a little deeper. You know, they've just heard of you, get them to subscribe to your newsletter. They've done something online, get them to show up at an event. And if you can move people through that process, activating them a little more along the way, this is how you build it. Does that fit into what we're talking about?
I mean, if you look at a number of the successful movements that we've studied, you know, so much is about that offline, one-on-one action that you take. You know, with drunk driving reduction, for instance, one of the reasons why Mothers Against Drunk Driving, or MAD, has been so successful since it was founded by Candy Leitner in the 80s, is, you know, one of the first things they did was start local MAD chapters and victims and survivors support groups, right? A parent, family member, lost a child, lost a niece or nephew. And what MAD did was draw the circle bigger to define victims of drunk driving crashes, not just as the person killed or injured,
right,
but the family and the communities, right?
And the friends,
And create support groups where, you know, just show up. Go to one of these grief and loss support groups, providing the solace and the peer support that's needed in a time of crisis like that. In the long run, those support group members were bonded to each other, and as they worked through their loss, later became very strong advocates for changing drunk driving laws and pushing for social norm change. You know, and each of the movements do a lot to get people to just show up, get involved. You know, gun rights has a big advantage in this area because, you know, NRA is a membership organization. You get the NRA magazine, get invited to, you know, gun shows and shooting matches, and they have community events, and, you know, there's clam bakes, and there's activities for the kids, and they have raffle prizes, and, you know, often the prizes is 10 free guns, right? So it's, so the members of NRA worship together, work together, and they have all of these different small but important ways where they're building affinity and community in these networks. And those networks then are what they draw on when it comes time to do the political and educational advocacy work.
Yeah, the point that you make is that a lot of people probably see the NRA, see its Wayne LaPierre, or the woman who has the TV show on NRA TV and so on, and they think it's a top-down organization, and they think, oh, it throws money at campaigns. But the strength, and you point out, the strength has been in the disproportion between the robust robust and actually, you know, entwined with people's lives and communities, grassroots of the NRA, and up until now, not nearly the same thing in the Prevent Gun Violence group, although, as you point out, that's changing. Speak to that.
It's changed really in the last 36 months. But, you know, the NRA counts its membership as just under or close to 5 million, and that has been a deliberate strategy since the 1990s. You know, after the – well, let's go back to the 90s for a minute. You know, this was a very different political climate in this country. First of all, we had a very strong federal gun ban, right? We had the assault weapons ban
from 78 to whatever,
1993.
Yeah.
After that, NRA established a grassroots division, started to build up its grassroots, focused on membership, set up an 800 hotline so that, you know, if anyone anywhere in the country felt their Second Amendment freedoms were going to be infringed, they could call, and, you know, a team of people would show up at that town council meeting or at that state meeting, right? So they organized, were very deliberate and systematic, and when you interview leaders at the NRA today, they talk about their structure of their organization as an upside-down pyramid where 5 million members sit on top, and at the very bottom, you know, the policy shop and their political victory fund, their PAC, are just the tip of the spear, because they know they can throw as much money at an election as they want, but unless voters show up and hold politicians accountable for what they're looking for in terms of loosening up the gun laws, then they're not going to be successful. So they were and continue to be very savvy and deliberate about that. Now, since the 90s up until very recently, the only organization that would be equivalent to the NRA from the gun control side would have been Brady Campaign, not a membership organization. You know, by the time of one of the worst tragedies in recent years, that we're coming up on the 6th anniversary of the Sandy Hook elementary school massacre, when, of course, 26 elementary school students and educators were killed in Newtown, Massachusetts. At that point in time, in 2012, NRA was nearly 5 million in members. Brady had around 400,000 members. So you had a gun control movement at the grassroots level that was just one-tenth the size of the gun rights movement. But that would be surprising if you don't follow this closely because, of course, the liberal media bias, you know, there's a focus on gun violence victims, and there's a public opinion bias. You know, more than 95% of Americans say they want common sense gun laws, Democrats, Republicans, gun owners, non-gun owners alike. But our public policies do not reflect that, and that, in my opinion, is a direct result of the real imbalance between the grassroots on the gun control side being so small relative to the NRA. Now since Everytown, Shannon Watts started Moms Demand Action out of Indianapolis, merged up with Mayor Bloomberg's Mayors Against Illegal Guns to create Everytown for Gun Safety, 2014. By the time I finished the research for How Change Happens in November of 2017, they had about 4 million supporters. Then, of course, this year we had Parkland on February 14th, and when you add the faces and voices of the students coming out of Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School with Everytown, you've got a gun control movement that is tipping over 5 million. So it's actually for the first time in several decades, you got an equal and opposite grassroots fight going on.
Yeah, no, I think that this is at least going to make the what happens next interesting, because it has been so one-sided for the last decade and a little more. And now to see how will this play out. We've got about 15 minutes left, so I want to revert to being organized here for a second and say that you point out six principles that seem to be the thing that make some social change happen and some fail. And we've covered really three of them. Number one, focus on the grassroots. We've talked about that. Number two, the recognition of the importance of states and local efforts, the 10-10-10 plus 20 equals 50. Let's talk about the third one, which is this commitment to changing norms and attitudes as well as policy, or as you say, change hearts and policy. Let me ask a question, because it's something that is near and dear to my heart, and that what is the role of storytelling and narrative in that this piece of it?
Well, I think storytelling is key to changing hearts and minds. And really the emphasis with this insight in How Change Happens is that you can't just go for policy change, right? You can't just change the rules of the game. You've got to change attitudes, beliefs, and opinions, and how people feel about these issues. Because otherwise the rules won't stick, and you've got to win in the court of public opinion as much as in the state houses and the courthouses, right? So telling stories, and within those stories, you've got to find the right message. And by that, I mean winning movements find these universal sentiments, these emotional concepts that connect with people at their core. You know, for tobacco, they really started to focus on truth, right? The first tobacco control campaigns and ads were targeted to Gen X, my generation. Mm-hmm. And we were, the Gen X profile was, we were slackers, we were rebellious, we were anti-authoritarian, we gave you grunge, you're welcome. You know, and so how do you tap into convincing Gen Xers not to smoke, to make smoking not cool, right? Well, so they got into that rebellious mindset with these ads, and through the Truth Initiative, you know, did the body bags campaigns. And, you know, you had these extreme videotaped events piling up body bags at the feet of Philip Morris headquarters. And they were gritty, right? And the message was, if you really want to rebel, if you really want to be cool, the suits, the guys in the suits at the tobacco companies are trying to hook you on these addictive cigarettes. So the cool thing to do, the rebellious thing to do, is not smoke, right?
Right.
So
I mean, I always think of that picture of when I think the 7 or 9 heads of tobacco companies appear at Congress, all white men, all in expensive suits, and they became the man that you, as you say, to be really cool, you stick it to them, you don't do what they want to sell you.
Exactly. Those were the Waxman hearings, and that was in the public consciousness. Now, with late-stage millennials, Gen Z, the next generation, you know, smoking rates are down to under 6% for young people today. How did that happen? You know, the next wave of the Truth ads were, you know, things like Catmageddon on YouTube going viral.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It doesn't say don't smoke, it's bad for you. It doesn't say smoking gives you bad breath. It doesn't say smoking will kill you. It says, if you smoke, secondhand smoke can kill your pets of cancer. So teens and tweens, you know, millions share these videos because they want to look at stupid pet videos, my kids included, and then they get the message. And so that's one of the reasons why norms have shifted.
Yeah, one of the things,
LGBT marriage equality, they really started to focus their effort around the idea of love. You know, for a long time there was a focus on this rights activism. You discriminate against me if you won't let me marry. I have a right. And then they said, well, but we want to get married because we're in love, just like different sex couples. So, you know, the stories that they would tell would focus on, you know, when they were defending the marriage law in Massachusetts. There's two religions in Massachusetts, Catholicism and hockey. Right? So they found, you know, two hockey moms raising their son, who happened to be a statewide champion. And, you know, it's them getting up at 4 in the morning in the dark, freezing their butts off at 5 a.m. practices and celebrating on the ice at the big win, just like all the other families, normalizing the love between these couples and their families, right? And so each campaign really found their love, their truth. With the NRA, it's all about freedom, the freedom to own and access guns.
So
and then linking stories around those very fundamental, universal emotions.
That's right. And what I wanted to get back to is that initial question, which was about storytelling, which is what you're saying is you can tell stories, but first find out where the leverage point is in people's attitudes and emotions. And you can waste a lot of energy telling stories that if you don't tap into those. And in both of the cases you mentioned, as you said about gay marriage, the emphasis had been on rights. And they realized, wait a minute, we switch it to love and we touch people much more. The messages about smoking had been health ones. They shifted it to cool. That made a difference. I know littering in Texas, when they came up with, you know, don't mess with Texas, as a littering campaign, it was how do you tap into what Texans care about, what Texans feel, and so that what we're saying is storytelling is important, but you gotta really know what emotion you want to tap and how you're going to do it.
Exactly.
Let's see the next one. Reckon with your adversarial allies. We spoke about it briefly. Just expand on that a little bit.
That just has to do with, you know, every cause, every campaign, you've got internal strife people have genuine policy disagreements. You know, in tobacco control, there was a wing that wanted to try and negotiate and settle with tobacco, get marketing out of schools, away from young people, get rid of vending machines, but allow tobacco to continue to be sold, right? And then there was a wing that just thought tobacco needs to be put out of business, it should not have a license to operate, and everything in between. And then you had the non-smokers' rights groups, right? Each movement, even when they win, there's a lot of bumps in the road because of this. And I think the leaders that we interviewed talked about getting not 100% consensus, but enough of a consensus and a direction so that they could move forward together kind of with a majority. And that seemed to work. And you have, you know, there's some really tactical lessons that come out of the book. When the LGBT marriage equality advocates were going for a law in New York to allow gay marriage, you know, what, because groups previously kind of fought over things like donor lists and resources and media attention and all these things, they set up a simple MOU so that leading groups in New York like HRC, Freedom to Marry, Empire State Gay Pride Coalition, said, okay, we're each going to put in our donor list. We're each going to put in X percent of funding. We're going to do this campaign, New Yorkers United for Marriage. Nobody gets to call it their campaign. You don't brand it with any one nonprofit. It becomes this universal campaign. And here's what we're going to do with anything that's left over at the end, win or lose. And so they negotiated up front how to mete out all of those things that nonprofits tend to squabble over so that then they could focus on the win. And that's, you know, an applicable way many nonprofits can move forward.
Yeah, I think on this one, the Reckon with Adversarial Allies is the one that I think people doesn't jump out at people, you know? Another, like I said, with the 10, 10, 10, 20, 50, it doesn't jump out at people, but what you're saying, if you pretend it's not there, if you let it fester, or if you degenerate into that and lose your eyes from the prize, everything else you do probably will fail because of the wasted energy that happens in these adversaries. And so what you're saying is notice it, clarify it, deal with it, and then do all that other stuff.
Yeah. And every movement has it. You know, when a funder in the tobacco control movement said, this is a movement that eats its own.
Right. And that's one of the most successful.
And one of the biggest success stories in the book. So no one's immune.
Right. Okay, I want
to. It kind of ties to the next practice, breaks
right.
in business as usual,
yes.
Where, you know, the role of business in this movement is really interesting. It's controversial. You know, with tobacco, you could be purist against the tobacco industry and want to put it out of business. And that is not the tack that ended up being the winning approach, right? It was how do you chip away at tobacco industry power and reduce smoking rates, doing norm change, behavior change, that, you know, ended up winning the day. And we can talk about, you know, the different ways that we saw companies weighing in on these movements, if you'd like.
Well, since I want to make sure we get to the leaderful part, because that, as you say, is the ultimate decider sort of what works and what doesn't, what succeeds and what doesn't, is how leadership functions. But let's just say just a little bit more about business. What you're saying is that there have been campaigns or movements, there have been situations where the business seemed to be the enemy. And there's been a change over the last few years. It has something to do with the internet. It has something to do with all sorts of things. But now you should look at where you can make business or some businesses your ally. And they have learned that being on the right side of social issues is good for business, and that there's this win-win double bottom line thing, which is worth tapping into. And what you're saying is it's a mistake to look at it the old way.
Exactly.
Yeah. So leaderful, as I think you say, you conclude that a movement is only as effective as its leaders. And so who are effective leaders? And we've got about 3.5 minutes.
So some of the leaderful approaches that we saw in the book were exhibited by leaders like Evan Wolfson, the founder of Freedom to Marry, Matt Myers, Bill Novelli from the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids. What they do is push power and authority out to grassroots, let the victims and survivors and the people with the lived experience of the issue lead, and kind of take a back seat and play that orchestra conductor role where you're trying to get everybody around you moving in the same direction, but you're not dictating from the top down. There's kind of a spectrum of leadership in movements. On the far left, you could have leaderless movements. They're completely chaotic. It's anarchy. You know, Occupy Wall Street had a total flat egalitarian leadership structure. No one was in charge. Everybody had an equal vote. They had more than 21 different policy platforms they were campaigning for, and they got a lot of attention, and then it kind of fizzled. Now, certain messages stuck, right? The cry for the 99%.
Yeah, and they changed the conversation. They changed the conversation, but they didn't achieve anything specific. It's kind of a good news, bad news in that one. Go ahead.
Exactly. And then on the other extreme, you've got leader-led movements, which are top-down. You've got a big 800-pound guerrilla organization trying to dictate and control the resources, and it suffocates what's happening at the grassroots local chapter affiliate level. So what you want to find the balance, leader-full, between those two extremes, where you've got leadership coming from the grass tops, coming from the national perspective, but you're pushing power and authority and resources out to the grassroots. And again, letting those people with the lived experience of the issue, whatever it is, lead. Part of that, it's very hard to do because it's to be good at it, you've got to be kind of egoless, right?
Mm-hmm.
Organizers will tell you, you know, the best coalition leaders lose themselves in the organization, in the coalition, right? It's not about having your organization's brand or name get all the credit in the short term. It's about driving for these common wins. And, you know, when you look back, yeah, everybody can take credit for the win. But if you try and dominate or hoard the resources, you know, then you're going to suffocate the movements. And it's a very delicate leadership approach. You got to have a long game in view. You got to be able to kind of subsume your personal ego and your organizational's identity to advance these larger causes.
And
and it's one of the reasons why most movements and issues don't move forward.
Right. And I was going to say, it seems like it's a daily dance. It's not like you do it once and it works. I mean, you've got to constantly be, you know, that dance between leading enough to keep in the direction and letting go. Now, one of the things you point out as an example of how this leaderful leadership is happening is that the Students of Parkland, Florida, topped Fortune's 2018 list of the world's 50 greatest leaders, and the Me Too movement was in third place. Collective action being chosen by Fortune magazine as our greatest leaders.
Yeah, it was the first time in the history of those lists that it wasn't a company CEO or a country president. Individual,
yeah.
But these collective Me Too, Bill and Melinda Gates, leaders from Parkland, recognizing, you know, out of many one.
Yeah,
the power
and to me,
that collective
model. I didn't know that until you mentioned it in some interviews I read. But that to me is something I'm going to think one of the best things that has happened in 2018 is this, A, that it's bubbling up, B, that it's recognized, C, that it's working. This gives me hope. We got to close it here. I did want to say that at one point in something I read, you said, what were the three conclusions you reached? And one was that change is possible, change is nonpartisan, and change is deliberate. The book is How Change Happens, Why Some Social Movements Succeed While Others Don't. And in addition to the stories, the analysis, the principles, there's some very specific, towards the end of the book, almost like a little handbook of if you're working on a movement, and you face this challenge, try this. If you want to look how to apply this principle, apply this. So what I'm saying is, and the other thing I mentioned when I said it was 220 pages, the reason I mentioned that is I'm saying this is not a big academic tome, even though it comes out of, you know, university research. This is a handbook kind of a book that is easy to read and then easy to use. So you can learn more at howchangehappens.com. The book I've just talked about, you can follow the Global Social Enterprise Initiative on Twitter at GSEI_Georgetown. For this conversation and many other interviews, articles, to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. If you want to receive a weekly email announcement where I tell you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, there's usually 7 or 8 articles that I think flesh out the conversation, sign up at my site or email me at temcnally@mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform podcast on iTunes, where you'll find years of podcasts. Michael Lewis, Jeremy Scahill, Naomi Klein, Van Jones, Connie Rice, on and on. Thanks to Mark Maxwell, George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices, and most of all, you, my listeners, please share this podcast widely. Thank you, Leslie Crutchfield. Keep up the good work.
Thanks for having me.